Public Safety Director Nolan Espinda joined us here on The Conversation following his visit to Maui after the uprising by inmates there because of overcrowding. But whether he gets to keep his job is still up in the air. HPR's Kuvehi Hiraishi joins us in the studio to talk about his confirmation hearing.
Hello, Catherine. Good morning. That's right. So they did have an initial taking of testimony last week in front of the Senate Public Safety Committee, but no decision was rendered. And I think a lot of folks were waiting for questions to come from legislators on high-profile events like the Maui riot. So what's happening now is tomorrow, legislators are going to have a chance to ask all these questions of DPS staff, including Espinda himself, and then a following confirmation hearing on Thursday. So they're kind of parsing it out there.
So what did they do on Friday then during that hearing?
They basically took in testimony. So everyone, and there was about a good amount, I'd say like 150, 200 pages of testimony were submitted exactly, and 100 of them are overwhelmingly in support of Espinda. And this came from other state agency heads, as is common, but also past and current, or former and current employees of DPS coming forward for and against him, though, too, because we did hear from folks who, you know, at the beginning of their testimony were saying, you know, I'm doing this and I'm risking my job because I'm speaking out against my superior, but we think this is important. So at the testimony, I pulled some of the clips from folks who were there. And this first one focused on the Maui. So the Maui riots that happened in March are probably going to be at the top of the agenda for tomorrow's informational briefing from the Public Safety Department, I mean the Public Safety Committee. And DeMont Carner, who you know, I think, former inmate and also a big advocate for inmates currently in Hawaii at the legislature, he chimed in to say, you know, I've been in these riots. I know how these things work. And this is what he took away from the Maui riot situation.
Different types of riots tell you what's happening in the prison system. The riot that we just had, they didn't take no hostages and they didn't hurt people. What does that tell you? That's because the prisoners are sick. Something's wrong there. It's a cry for help. So I just say to you that we're moving backwards in time. I already told you folks in 4 years ago that this was a bad choice because he doesn't have the temperament to be a director. He has a great temperament to be a warden, a tough warden, but not a director. I think we need new leadership, and I pray that you guys will not confirm him. Thank you.
That's right. So Nolan has spent 32 years in public safety and mostly on the corrections side, warden at Halawa and warden at OCCC. So lots of experience there, but you can kind of, that takes the temperature, I think, for a lot of folks inside the system and their views of how it's been handled by the department. This riot has been handled because we do know that some inmates were then flown from Maui to join folks up at Halawa, and then some were in the end weren't actually involved to some extent, so they flew them back. So this sort of timeline of events and circumstances in terms of overcrowding, which Espinda has said is part of the problem and part of the circumstances surrounding why inmates rioted, those things will be sort of picked out tomorrow at the committee hearing.
And we have heard him raise the flag about the overcrowding situation. We've heard the Maui lawmakers do the same thing, saying, hey, we need to address Maui now. You know,
right.
Oahu has problems, but we need to address Maui too.
No, it is true. And we have heard from other advocates, according to the committee chair, Nishihara, Clarence Nishihara, head of the deputy of the department, Department of Public Safety's handling of these events. He says he's been receiving information from advocates and sort of families of inmates in Maui's jail to kind of pull that out, and he will be presenting some of that tomorrow that we may not have heard of so far in that particular situation. But another big issue that will be talked about tomorrow is the law enforcement division. So that's the division that oversees all the sheriffs within DPS and their handling of some recent shootings, lethal shootings. I think one that folks might remember is the, he was handicapped, he was mentally disabled to some extent, according to his mother, but he was shot on the grounds of the Capitol by a deputy sheriff. So that issue will also be coming up tomorrow at the hearing. And one individual, a deputy sheriff lieutenant himself, who's been part of DPS for about 20 years, Sean Suha, came in opposing Espinda, but also saying that this law enforcement division really has some other issues on you know, not just not being ill-prepared, but in terms of the weapons that they have, access to.
If you believe that buying weapons and then training them and not issuing them to the field is proper direction, I posit to you that that's incorrect. I posit to you that that homeless gentleman that was killed right here off the Capitol grounds, maybe, just maybe, he would be alive today had those deputies had a less lethal weapon like a shotgun with a beanbag. That's my position. That's my personal opinion. We have weapons that have been purchased that are not even in policy.
That's right. So the weapons purchases will be part of questioning tomorrow. But at the end of that hearing, Espinda did get to sort of come in and talk about the accomplishments, which, you know, are big accomplishments for this division or for this department. He's cut overtime abuse by folks that work for DPS. And also, according to his calculations, he's had no cancellations for inmate visits, which was also a big issue when he took the helm back in 2015. So we did hear from Espinda on how he sees what he's going into in terms of the next 4 years.
I will acknowledge that there's still much work to do, not the least of which is earning accreditation for our sheriffs via the Commission on Accreditation for Law Enforcement Agencies, or CALEA. I fully recognize and accept the responsibility that progress towards this goal has not met even my expectation. I will say, however, that the same dogged persistence that fostered the institutional changes noted for the accomplishments earlier will be required to fulfill many of the steps as we go forward in reaching the CALEA accreditation goal. And I'm personally committed.
So that, yes, the accreditation will probably be the last item on the agenda tomorrow.
Yeah, it's interesting, though. But, you know, to their credit, everybody that works at public safety, those are tough jobs.
Yes.
Very tough jobs.
High stress. Long hours.
Yeah, and so we're glad we have folks in there working in the trenches, but we'll see what happens later this week.
Yes, thanks, Catherine.
Thanks so much. That was Ku'uwe Hiraishi, and you can find all her reports online at hawaiipublicradio.org. This is The Conversation on listener-supported Hawaii Public Radio. We now check in with astronomer Christopher Phillips and HPR's Dave Lawrence with your Monday Stargazer.
Stargazer time, our weekly look into the massive universe around our ridiculously small planet, also what we can try and spot in our dark skies. As usual, we are fortunate to have the expertise of astronomer Christopher Phillips at our disposal. Hey, Christopher, welcome back. What's going on this week?
Hey, Dave. It's good to be back. So this week, stargazers look out for Venus in the morning sky before dawn and Mars in the western sky after sunset, where it will be visible till around 10 p.m. The Moon is passing through its first quarter phase this week and will still enable us to stargaze for faint objects right through till the end of the week.
And I understand you've got some news this week that allows one of your British pronunciations to shine brightly as we focus on one of our family members in the solar system and some gas there.
Yeah, so back in 2013 and 14, NASA's Curiosity rover detected spikes in methane gas in the Martian atmosphere. The same spikes were also observed by the European Space Agency's Mars Express probe and in the same location. Now, here on Earth, methane is emitted by most living organisms as a byproduct of the metabolic process. This correlation between the two detections has sent astrobiologists into a spin, as perhaps it may be evidence for life beneath the surface of the red planet.
And you're thinking like caverns with creatures running around kind of stuff, or just a little bit more low-tech than that?
Absolutely. So we're actually talking about probably Martian microbes. They're very, very small indeed.
And that's a good point, because this stuff can also be produced by things other than life.
It can indeed, and that's the reason why we should temper our excitement here. Naturally occurring geological and chemical processes surfaces can also create this kind of gas seen by the probes.
And what's the method of finding the source?
Well, that's what scientists are working on right now. The main focus of the investigation is not how the methane is being produced, but where on Earth it is coming from, or in this case, where on Mars. Once we find out, then we can worry about the how.
And where would you suggest, Christopher, people be poking around?
Well, if I was an astrobiologist, I would be looking at faults or tectonic features similar to those found here on the Earth. If there is outgassing by natural processes, the chances are it will come from these places. But if we find gas in other locations on Mars, then this does raise the interesting prospect of those tiny Martian microbes.
Prospecting for microbes.
Indeed.
It's Christopher Phillips and another fascinating journey into the universe around our small planet with Stargazer. Appreciate it.
You are welcome, Dave.
And I'm Dave Lawrence. Catch you next week. And we keep Stargazer at HawaiiPublicRadio.org.
Support for Stargazer comes from Haleakala Ranch, with a legacy of livestock, conservation, and land stewardship since 1888, working to create, maintain, and preserve open spaces for the Maui community. More at HaleakalaRanch.com.
This is The Conversation, and I'm Catherine Cruz. Our Federal Criminal Justice Center hasn't been overhauled in 30 years. In December, President Trump signed the First Step Act into law. The goal? To reduce recidivism and reduce certain mandatory minimum sentences. As a follow-up, the president announced an effort last week called the Second Step Act. Former U.S. Attorney Brett Tolman worked closely with members of Congress and presidential advisors to draft the First Step Act. He spoke with HPR's Ryan Finnerty about what's in the law and what we can expect in the Second Step Act.
For roughly three decades, Congress has basically been increasing the number of federal criminal laws and the length of the punishment for violating those criminal laws. And we had the war on drugs, and we had, you know, other issues that came up. And it's almost like both parties, Democrat and Republican, were trying to outdo each other and being tough on crime. The problem was nobody was really paying attention to the cost of all of that, both in financial terms and in human terms. And nobody was studying that what the states were doing, and that they were figuring out a better path. And I say better, you have places like Texas where they were getting overpopulation a big concern, and the number of those incarcerated and was a huge burden on the state. They made a couple of very modest changes and started to close prisons. They ultimately closed 8 prisons, saved over $4 billion, and reduced their recidivism rate and reduced their crime rate. And so it got our attention. And so for the last 7 or 8 years, we've started to fashion a similar reform to Texas and other states, where they started to incentivize or reward those that are incarcerated to lower their risk of recidivism, have more training and jobs and faith-based participation groups and those types of activities, that while measuring whether or not they were reducing their risk of recidivism. And so we implemented a similar structure that would allow folks to get into halfway house or home confinement sooner if they would reduce their risk of recidivism. So that was the heart of the First Step Act, as well as fixing some of the out-of-whack sentences and some other malfunctions in the system.
So there were changes on the sentencing side as well as the rehabilitation side.
That's right. There are some absurd results that happened in the federal system. Not a lot of people really truly understood it, but we were able to tackle 4 or 5 of those and fix them, and even do some things like, you know, many years ago, Congress passed a law that said if you were good while in prison, there's no parole in the federal system. So they passed a law that said if you're good, you could earn 54 days off of your sentence per year for good behavior. Well, it turns out that the Bureau of Prison was only allowing 47 days. And so we fixed that to add the 7 days to those that have earned it. Just little things like that that were important, because it will result in thousands of folks that have earned their right to be out actually getting out.
Well, the First Step Act was signed into law about 3 months ago by President Trump, and we should say that was a bipartisan bill. It had support from both Democrats and Republicans. President Trump recently announced the Second Step Act as his next initiative on criminal justice. What does that entail?
So I think we've seen that the First Step Act was aimed at fixing some of the laws and addressing some of the sentencing and addressing some of the issues while they're incarcerated. The Second Step Act is going to be aimed at what happens when they get out. 95% of all those incarcerated are going to get out. And so this is going to focus on helping them find housing or get jobs or reduce their risks of recidivism. You know, some folks don't even realize that they can't even open a bank account nowadays. The banks are kicking them out of their banks and or refusing to open an account. And so there's a lot that has to go on the outside after they get out so that they can reenter society and actually, you know, avoid committing crimes again and be a, you know, someone that makes a meaningful contribution.
Brett, do we know what some of the common factors are that drive up recidivism rates, the rate of people returning to jail after they've been released?
We do. The top factor is employment. If they have a job or if they are enrolled in an education program, it is those are the largest factors that affect recidivism. Now, certainly having, you know, a support system or having, you know, the ability to maybe move or live in an area that is more amenable to a better lifestyle is important. But the biggest factor are jobs, and then after that, education.
And so what will be some of the provisions of the Second Step Act that will try to address those issues?
So there's a few things that may occur. We're looking at lifting the ban on Pell Grants so that those that are incarcerated, if they can show that they qualify, that they may be able to get some assistance in working with certain colleges and universities to continue education. There's an effort to, you've heard the phrase, maybe ban the box or those kinds of terms. What that means is, look, we are okay with employers getting criminal history of a candidate. But what this effort is don't require it right up front. Let them fill out an application and let them try to get an interview. And then if the employer is going to offer them a job, let the employer then do the criminal history check. And we've seen it in 33 states result in individuals getting more interviews and being selected. And employers will tell you that in the majority of instances, the formerly incarcerated are some of their best employees, most appreciative best employees. And so that's important. We're also going to look at expungement and see if there is a way or a path forward to get in expungement in the federal system, which is basically non-existent right now.
I know it's only been a few months, but do we have any idea about what kind of results the First Step Act has produced in its early lifespan so far?
Yeah, you know, the president highlighted this just a few days ago in the celebration at the White House and had five formerly incarcerated that were there, and their stories are very compelling. They all served long sentences, but they are well-meaning and intent on contributing. And so there are some great stories, but we estimate roughly about 500 individuals have been released under the First Step Act, that there are thousands more that qualify, but we're still trying to push DOJ and the Bureau of Prisons to implement the First Step Act fully.
And I know you were involved pretty heavily in the effort to draft the First Step Act and then get it passed through Congress, which is no easy feat in the
right.
current political climate. What kind of challenges do you envision in implementing the Second Step Act?
Well, I'm a, I'm going to confess, if we don't get the First Step Act fully implemented and show that, you know, it can be done and that we're serious about it, I think it's going to be very difficult to get that next step done. So we do have to do that. We've got to get, you know, DOJ on board and the Bureau of Prisons and get it implemented and funded. If it doesn't get funded, for example, then it takes away a lot of the motivation to try to get another package together. But assuming we get that, then I think what we're going to see is perhaps legislation that's not quite as broad and sweeping and large as what the First Step Act was, but is more rifle shot approaches to certain issues. And I think that's very doable, whether it's all in one bill or whether or not we spread that out to multiple bills. I think there is an appetite to try to, you know, get folks who have paid their debt to society for the crimes they committed to, you know, avoid committing another crime and be a meaningful part of our communities.
All right, Brett Tolman, former U.S. Attorney, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
And we will have links to more information on the First and Second Step Acts posted with this story at hawaiipublicradio.org. You know, joining us for today's reality check is Honolulu Civil Beat reporter Marcel Henry. He has the pulse on transportation issues, and in his column today, Wayfinding, he's focusing in on the dreaded road usage charge. Morning, Marcel.
Dreaded. Well, happy Monday, Catherine.
Happy Monday. Well, dreaded because I think that was the reaction at the first hearings, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's been widely panned by the public in some of these early public meetings on the proposal. And basically what I try and lay out in today's column is it would actually be in the best interest of a lot of the rural drivers who are, you know, the most vociferously opposed to this. It's actually in their best interest to switch to something like a mileage-based tax over the gas tax that they pay now.
Yeah, and we talked to folks that were at that first meeting, and someone said, oh, folks didn't get it. And someone else said, well, you know, I think they just were digging in their heels. You know, they don't want to give up their one-ton trucks, and they're worried.
Right. There's that. The thing is, if you're driving a one-ton truck out on Leeward Coast, Waianae, west Oahu, what you got to factor into this is you are already paying a very heavy premium in the gas tax that you're buying compared to people with lighter, more fuel-efficient cars. Electric vehicles currently aren't paying any gas, fuel tax at the pump because they don't go to the pump. That's a whole other policy discussion, but really it just lays out that, you know, I think what's being missed in a lot of this discussion, you know, certainly a mileage tax would be based on distance, and that would on its face be bad for people that are, you know, out in West Oahu and Leeward Coast and in the neighbor islands. But you've got to consider what you were already paying now and what that mileage based tax, how that would compare to the gas tax that you're paying now.
Yeah, I mean, your point is really make it fair for everybody. I mean, you drive, you said, an electric car, right, or a hybrid or something?
Prius, yeah. Mm-hmm. I drive a 2009 Prius. And, you know, it's the column is a little tongue-in-cheek about EV and Prius. And you know, I'd say certainly that we should be moving in this direction to reduce emissions as much as possible. If you're worried about climate change, these are worthy and positive goals that you want to go towards. The question then is, even in the perfect scenario, say you have everybody driving electric vehicles that are powered, you know, solar powered during the day, that kind of thing, you're still going to need some sort of a tax model that is going to support those roads so you're not just driving them over roads that are plagued with potholes and the like.
Yeah, you know, when we had Ed Sniffen on, he talked about, they're trying to change the mix and the asphalt so that the roads are in better shape going forward. And he talked about Oregon, that they were looking at that model there. But people just need to know that they're just trying to educate folks to a different way of keeping that highway fund replenished.
Yeah. Right. And Oregon, you know, I spoke with the folks in Oregon. Basically, if you have a car that has less than 20 mpg, you benefit from this pilot program that they've launched with a pool of about 1,500 voluntary drivers. That's not to say that we would directly replicate what's happening in Oregon. It's not to say that we want to completely disincentivize EVs and the like. I think there's actually a very strong demand in Hawaii for EVs, regardless of where you go with this state tax. But it's really to just kind of start the discussion on what a program would look like. So.
All right. Well, thanks so much, Marcel, and we'll keep tracking this. We appreciate it.
Thanks, Catherine.
That was our reality check featuring reporter Marcel Henry. Check out CivilBeat.org for his full story. This week, we're highlighting our call-in shows where we talk to our county mayors. Today, we start on the Garden Isle with Mayor Derek Kawakami. It's been 4 months since he was sworn into office, and Kauai continues to rebuild following last year's devastating flash floods. Housing and homelessness are a top priority for the island, as is helping enforcing laws to crack down on illegal vacation rentals. At the beginning of the legislative session, Kawakami went before the powerful money committees with hands outstretched in the annual mayor's trek to the Capitol to argue their case for a larger share of the hotel room tax. It was a different perspective since he made the decision not to seek re-election to his House seat and go after the mayor's post.
It was an eye-opener. You know, we've had a number of bills in front of the legislature that our planning departments have been testifying in support of. Of course, you do know that our hardworking representatives and senators are oftentimes pulled in a million and one ways. And so it was received, I think, with a reality check. You're having a mayor now come in front of you to really spell out what we're being dealt with. We have a number of vacation rentals that are in our neighborhoods. Some have been grandfathered in. But in my opinion, it should run with ownership. And so if somebody were to sell their property, that's one way where we can start recovering our neighborhoods. The other thing that we need is we need to have the legislature perhaps begin the conversation of having these type of appeals go straight to court. Right now, what's happening is we are notifying these illegal vacation rental operators to cease and desist. We are imposing fines. They come and appeal, and the way that they appeal is they go through our planning commission. We have to have a hearings officer. You know, that commission is volunteers, so they don't meet regularly. And it's expensive to hire a hearings officer. And so these cases get dragged out for years at times. It's a huge cost to our taxpayers. If we can have these type of cases go straight to court, have a judge and jury rule on it, impose those fines, that's one way where we can address the backlog and the frustration from our people, Catherine. People are frustrated because they know that these operations are illegal, yet they continue to operate while they're being dragged out through the appeal process. And so these are things that the legislature can give the counties and partner with us so that we can finally address something that is a problem on each and every island. This is not just a Kauai issue. This is an issue statewide.
Right, and we did just see a report, the survey from the Hawaii Tourism Authority about how residents feel about tourism. And it's more negative than it used to be.
Well, you know, here's the thing. Everything comes with a price, and what we're striving to do is to strike the right balance. I would like to note that, you know, the vacation rentals that are operating legitimately, they are paying into their fair share of infrastructure. You know, they are providing jobs. We do see the value. We are specifically looking at people that are operating illegally. As far as Kauai, you know, Kauai Visitors Bureau and their working group just came out with a tourism strategic plan. And basically what the visitor industry is saying is that we are at capacity. Like, if we stay status quo, that'll be good. They are finally addressing that we may have too many visitors that have put a strain on our infrastructure and our public resources.
Right, and that report says that the average count per day is like 25,000. and that that number has been really exceeded in recent years.
Yes, it has. And part of the reason why is the number of vacation rentals that have proliferated throughout our community.
So you're just saying enough already. Cap it.
Well, it's hard to cap things, and here's why, Catherine. There's a number of things that are really out of our wheelhouse, and we continue to strive to open those lines of communication. But really, we can't control how many flights land on Kauai. And so there's a big communication gap between the visitor industry, the counties, the state and federal government. We got to tell them, like, this is the number of rooms that we have available. This is our capacity. And that conversation has not happened. And it needs to before we get into a situation where we're just, I mean, the people are already frustrated. And we're trying to avoid having this type of situation boil over into something that's even uglier.
I know here on Oahu, we have a number of areas that are just loved to death, just sheer number of tourists and visitors that stop by every day. And I know, I believe the Park Service has an issue with Haleakala. What there on Kauai is stressed?
What area on Kauai is stressed? Everywhere. Everywhere. As I can name a few, Koke'e. You know, before the disasters in April, Haena, Wainiha, they were overstressed. Right now, you know, I'm a surfer. During the busy times, if I only have an hour to go surf at Waialae and I can't find the parking and I'm driving around for 30 minutes, you know, that's eroding at my quality of life. Really, we are over capacity as far as what our island can handle. And that's why we're really working with the state on their Haena State Master Plan. You know, when those floods hit, we hit that reset button and we say, okay, once we return to normalcy, how do we address the big girl in the room, which is the impact of the visitor industry on these little towns? And so we are setting a capacity out there. You make a reservation. There's a certain amount of parking stalls. If you want to come see some of our most beautiful places, you come in by shuttle. And really, we're at a point where we have to have the conversation. Do we impose fees on some of these very special places, our Wahipana? And my opinion is we should. We absolutely should have a fee for people to come and visit. We want people to visit, but there's a cost associated with it. And, you know, when I'm traveling with my wife, Monica, my daughter, Haley, my son, Christopher, and we go to places like Yellowstone, we're more than happy, and we expect to pay. And we're at a point where I think we have to have the conversation and really take a look at managing our resources wisely.
So really those floods have put the pause button on and given us an opportunity to say, hey, we need to let the resource recover and figure out a plan to manage.
Absolutely. You're absolutely right.
Now, as far as the TAT, while we can't cap tourism, I know you folks are asking, the counties are asking that we remove the cap on the counties, on what the counties receive every year.
Yes, we are. We're asking them to go back to the original intent. And you know what's funny, Catherine, I'll go have somebody take a look and look up Uncle Richard's opening statement when he was Speaker of the House. I'll have somebody find that, and I'll read you what the intent was way back in the 80s. But when we capped the TAT, I was the president of the Hawaii State Association of Counties. The legislature was originally considering to just take all of the TAT. That was the original plan. You got to remember, the state was in dire need. Teachers were getting furloughed. Services were getting cut. So they were in a desperate situation. And we were able to say, okay, you know what? Give us something that's predictable. So they capped it. So they capped the TAT. And the original intent was to be able to navigate through that Great Recession and then remove that cap and return it back to status quo. That has never happened. I don't think it will perhaps ever happen. I do know that the governor has a proposal that appropriates a percent to the counties. That does have some risk, but it also has some reward as well. I do know that Chair Luke has a measure that will allow the counties to impose a TAT tax at the county level. And that also poses some benefits for the counties as far as our ability to control our own destiny. And really, Catherine, that's really why Kauai County did a very brave brave thing by taking the 0.5% GE surcharge during an election year. Now, during an election year, we took a look at the budget. We took a look at everything that was on the horizon as far as what we could be receiving from the state. And we really made the unpopular decision, which was the right decision, to say, hey, we're going to take that 0.5% GE surcharge. This is a tax that's earmarked specifically for public transportation, specifically for infrastructure repair. And it's a good tax because that's the kind of tax that fixes infrastructure and keeps people working.
That was Kauai Mayor Derek Kawakami. It was an excerpt from one of our call-in shows that originally aired in February. Our listeners are given the opportunity to engage and get to know local newsmakers from across the state. And that wraps it up for The Conversation. Now back over to Pledge Central.